From Adversity to Abundance, hosted by entrepreneur and seasoned real estate investor Jamie Bateman, is the ultimate guide for active and passive investors seeking clarity, mental fitness, and the confidence to make inspired decisions in the world of real estate. With a decade plus of investing experience across various niches and a background as a combat veteran, former Army officer, and multi-million dollar mortgage note company owner, Jamie brings a wealth of knowledge and inspiring stories to each episode. Through weekly episodes featuring insightful interviews with industry leaders and solo explorations of mindset and strategy, listeners will uncover actionable advice and tips to overcome challenges and build lasting financial success. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting, From Adversity to Abundance is your roadmap to turning obstacles into opportunities and achieving financial freedom.
Jamie Bateman joins me here today. You can learn what his team is up to and how they can help you by heading over to LabradorLending.com. That's going to be a clickable link in the show notes. I really appreciate your time here, Jamie.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Jack. This is going to be fun.
So I told you, we probably got to start with the name. How did that come about?
Yeah, Labrador Lending. At the time, I lived on a street called Labrador Lane, or a lane called Labrador Lane. We do have a chocolate lab as well, and my kids were the Labradors in their elementary school, which I still haven't figured out why we need a mascot for elementary school. But anyway, that's the Labrador element of Labrador Lending. And we don't actually do a lot of lending, and we'll get into that. But from the borrower standpoint, we are a lender. And it kind of just flowed and the name stuck. And this is the name we've used, and it's out there for branding purposes. Labrador Lending, you know, people know it. Some people know it, not enough people know it, but that's the name we've gone with. And here we are. So I do have some other entities, but Labrador Lending is the forward facing entity.
Oh, sure. Well, let's start with your elevator version of how you found your way into real estate.
Sure. I had without really planning to go into real estate investing many years ago, you know, 2003 through 5-ish, I worked at a title company, quickly learned how little I knew about title insurance and you know, real estate transactions. And in 2010, I did purchase a rental property. But that was very, very passive. It was a condo, and everything went fine with that. But it wasn't until 2015 where I had been working a full-time job for many years. I'm sure many of your listeners can relate to this. You know, long commute, wife and kids, you know, getting the paycheck, stable income, and great benefits. And, but something was missing, and I really felt like every day was Groundhog's Day, and just started to really kind of miss, you know, working for myself and having a greater purpose and meaning, and that's really kind of what was missing. So instead of constantly whining about my commute, which I'm sure I did plenty of, I eventually switched my mindset to, you know, okay, how can this commute help me? How can those in my network help me? How can I help others as well? But instead of pointing to woe is me, you know, this sucks, this commute is terrible, my job is the same thing every day, you know, leave when it's dark, get home when it's dark, go to sleep, repeat the next day. Instead of kind of that mindset, I switched to, okay, I could listen to podcasts during my commute. And I started listening to Bigger Pockets and many other real estate related podcasts. And I started shifting my mindset, like I said, to, you know, what do I have going for me? What are my strengths? Who's in my network that I could rely on, that maybe I could start building something, you know, that could outlast this W-2 and that wasn't strictly tying my own time and efforts to a financial outcome, you know, as far as hour by hour, so to speak. So I then eventually went part-time and worked part-time at my W-2 for 7 years and slowly built my real estate business. At that time, it was primarily single-family rentals. So I think you know, there are many ways to get to quote-unquote success. And I have a podcast called From Adversity to Abundance, and we talk about this exact thing of getting to quote-unquote abundance. And that can take on many shapes and forms. But in my case, I didn't do the fast, you know, rip off the Band-Aid and jump in. I did have the ability to go part-time at work and had great benefits. And that allowed me to do the slow transition into real estate investing. And eventually, I'd been out of work for about 3 months. And once I came back, this was, I think, 2022, maybe late 2021, I realized that I just couldn't do the job anymore. My heart wasn't in it anymore. And then that first day back, I actually resigned and left my W-2 at that point. So it was a slow transition, but there were many different inflection points along the way. And just quickly, ever since 2018, I've been much more focused on mortgage note investing, which we can get into. My real estate investing experience is largely in the residential single family space.
Yeah. So what caused you to make that pivot?
Yeah. So leaving the W-2?
No, jumping into note investing.
Oh, got it. Sorry. So, I don't want to say it was just boredom, but I had built up a portfolio of single family rentals, and those were going well. And I think part of it was the market conditions made it harder and harder to. We were doing primarily the Burr method, of which I'm sure you and your listeners are familiar with. Somewhat, it was the industry and the market conditions that drove that. So real estate prices were going up and up, and property values were going up, and eventually interest rates went up as well, as we know. And so it made it harder to continue that model, to repeat that. But also it was a matter of, okay, I kind of have this now. I kind of understand it. All of our rentals are essentially the same. They're single family row homes, townhomes. And so it was working, but I kind of just wanted to pivot a little bit, not abandon the single family rentals. That's still a major part of my own portfolio, but it was a matter of, okay, I'm ready for a new challenge and I want to add some knowledge to my, another tool to my tool belt. And and it's all kind of part of the same cycle as how, that's how I see it. It's and now I kind of have a more complete view of the residential real estate investing cycle, if you will. So I didn't jump right into that either. I took my time in learning it, and we can get into that. But and then 2019, 2020, I really started to scale the mortgage note side of things. So I didn't abandon the rentals and just switch over, but I kind of was ready to add a new tool to my repertoire.
Well, you've given us two examples here now where you kind of transitioned what some people would see as slowly and cautiously. Is that something you picked up from your military background, or what was brought from your military background into your real estate investing business?
That's a great question. I mean, that's a broad one too. We could spend a lot of time on that. I do think there's an element of, we have people on either end of the spectrum. Some people who tend to overanalyze and don't take action. And then on the other end, it's like somebody who jumps in and isn't prepared, doesn't take the time to learn things. I don't know. I would say it's probably more of a personality driven thing. As in my case, as far as what I learned from the military, it was quite a bit. I joined the military because I was used to being a part of a team. I was involved in college athletics and played lacrosse in college, and just loved being a part of something bigger than myself. And so I kind of felt that void once I got into the quote unquote real world. And so I joined the military to serve, serve a greater mission, if you will. I did go through Federal Officer Candidate School. I was an officer. And so I guess I would say a lot of the traits that have transferred over from my military experience tend to relate to leadership and teamwork, and certainly attention to detail, planning. There's a lot of planning at the higher levels of the military and in the leadership positions for sure. And but attention to detail and following through, doing what you say you're going to do, being where you say you're going to be at whatever time you said you'd be there, that kind of thing. I think that helps you stand out in the real world for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There seems to be an ongoing thing regarding, I've even seen some TikTokers suggest that they are time blind or something, like as some sort of excuse. I don't get it myself, but I kind of understand what you're saying. But that may be just my generation. Like, you know, we just... So yeah, could we go back to the beginning? Like, do you recall your first real estate acquisition and the biggest lesson learned there?
Yeah, I mean, the first one that was really this condo that we purchased. And, you know, I'll be honest, we kind of got lucky because I just posted, you know, we purchased the deal in the MLS. My father was the realtor. That was another thing. My father had been a real estate agent for many years. My brother was a loan officer. So I started to say, wait, I've got people who know things. And I worked at a title company. I'd worked at a mortgage broker as well. And, you know, so we found the deal through my father on the MLS. It was a condo. It was less, you know, there are some risks with condos, but you know, it's a little bit more passive generally because you're not dealing with the exterior of the property typically. And put an ad on Craigslist for a tenant. And honestly, we've had the same tenant in there since 2010. And he's paid every time, if not ahead of schedule. So got a little lucky on that one. But once fast forward to 2015, that's when I really was kind of treating real estate, starting to treat it more like a business, real estate investing, more like a business and something a little more active. Those first few deals we did find on the MLS as well. And, you know, I think one of the lessons is that if you can overpay a little bit, you can make some mistakes, but if you are in this for the long term, real estate is a long-term game. It's not a get rich quick thing. It's certainly not real estate investing. You can make money in real estate quickly, but I was approaching this, you know, as a long-term investment. And so I think the lesson I would say that I learned from those early days is that you can make some mistakes and it's okay. But if you do make a couple mistakes here and there, real estate investing is very forgiving in the long term. And so if you don't make terrible mistakes, you know, but and there's always going to be risk. There's always going to be a reason not to get in. These are some bonus tips, I guess, bonus lessons. There are always reasons you should not take action. But so those are not going to go away 100%. But you've got to be somewhat prepared and feel comfortable enough, but push yourself out of your comfort zone a little bit and go ahead and take some action and realize, you know, even if this doesn't go exactly how I thought it was going to go, real estate is typically very forgiving in the long run.
You mentioned that at a certain point, your W-2 job just wasn't like you couldn't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a point where you found that the situation when it came to your real estate?
As far as not wanting to do the real estate anymore?
Yeah.
It's a great question. There have been times where it's just been a lot. And, you know, I'll just jump into one of the lessons I've learned through all of this real estate investing, which includes mortgage note investing. I also started a loan servicing company, did that for 3 years with, some partners. And, there were times a couple years ago where it was just overwhelming and it was just too much. That wasn't the fault of real estate investing. That was my fault for taking on too much and not saying no. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs can relate to this where, you know, they're doing some things pretty well and then they add too many things to their plate and then they start doing everything average at best. So there were definitely times where I wanted to you know, quit, I guess. But I would say, just quickly on this point, I think this is a key point. One of the lessons that I learned from all this is that I actually tend to be a little bit too stubborn sometimes, and not willing to quit. And so I was never really ready to quit real estate entirely, but I should have quit, for example, the loan servicing company, that venture. That's a whole, you know, whole big story there. I should have quit that before I did. You know, granted, we've got hindsight now to use. And so I try not to beat myself up too much for that. But at the end of the day, I did lose a good bit of money in that, but I've got some scars to prove it. In the end, I probably should have quit that earlier. So I would say, you know, just not taking on too many different projects at the same time and just staying focused is something I should have done a better job of. But I was never really ready to just quit real estate investing entirely.
Hmm. Yeah, it's one of those things. It's kind of a double-edged sword, isn't it? Where we're always told that we could be just moments away from gold. You know, don't stop digging.
That's true.
But there is a point where we need to just take a breath and be real with ourselves too.
It's so true. There are so many, you know, idioms and sayings like that where it's like it typically would apply, but in some cases maybe not. And so there's a lot of nuance. You know, as I've gotten more gray hair, I've learned to see more gray in the world. I've never used that one on a podcast, but I kind of liked it. But so you know, it's not a one size fits all. There's not a straight line to success. There are many different paths to success. And I do think, generally speaking, maybe for your younger listeners, that I would not try to start a bunch of things all at the same time and then never quit. You know, I would start, you know, pick a niche and focus on it and try that for a while and see how it goes. If you've learned it well and you can continue that in a more passive way and then add on to that, then great. But don't try to do everything all at once. And there's art to this for sure. There's a gut feel part of this. I don't really like to say like, oh, you start a business and if it's not positive, you know, if it's not cash flow positive in the first 2 months, then scrap it. Well, it's like there's a lot more nuance to that. And what type of industry are we talking about? And so, you know, there's art and science to it. And but I think something you touched on is really key, which is I didn't allow myself the space to really step back and look at these things, you know, from a higher level, you know, from a kind of zoom out, you know, zoomed out perspective. I was so in the weeds that I wasn't making great strategic decisions, even though I may have been making decent day-to-day decisions, if that makes sense.
Well, it's really hard to make that shift when you're dealing with something that's rife with emotion. That's typically where we're making our decisions. It's actually hard to kind of take a second and step out of that moment.
Yeah.
To be more strategic. Yeah.
Absolutely. And sometimes life throws things at you and then you're kind of almost forced to have some more space, but that can be a blessing in disguise too. So, I've in the last year, 1 to 2 years, I've really cut out a lot of things that weren't working and things I that were taking away from, you know, where my focus should have been. And this is not to say I did a terrible job with everything I was working on. I think I did a decent job, but at one point I was running 2 mortgage note funds. I was running a loan servicing company. I also still had my rentals. I've got a podcast. I put out a book at the same time. I'm not saying any of this to brag. I'm saying this was not smart. And I was also doing mentorship for people with note investing. So I cut that way down. I only have one mortgage note fund. I do not have the loan servicing company. The book is out. There's no more work with that. I do have the podcast still. I've cut a lot of things out and my focus, I just feel like I have a lot more space to focus on things and put, you know, my energy where it should be. And now we've reached a point where we're starting to kind of scale back up slowly. We've added some pieces such as asset management for others, and more to our mentorship program that are very, very related to the core, you know, focus anyway. It's not something that's way out in left field. And so I feel like I'm ready to strategically continue to scale.
You know, and you, to jump back into more metaphors, I guess I'm just going to do one more. You're kind of demonstrated there that there's a lot of proof around the concept of you're chasing multiple rabbits, you're not going to catch one.
I love it. Absolutely.
Yeah. So just to remind everybody, we are talking to Jamie over at LabradorLending.com. That's going to be a clickable link in the show notes. And if you found some value in what we're talking about so far, a like and subscribe on that YouTube video is going to go a long way. So really appreciate you spending the time with us. So let's jump into the note lending, Jamie.
Yeah.
Like, could you kind of give us a high level overview of how, what your business does and how it does it?
Absolutely. I do think I've gotten better at giving that high level overview. It can be easy to jump right into the weeds. What we do is I'm a mortgage note investor. So just to keep it simple, I buy the debt, and that may be for non-performing notes or performing notes. And so the core of what we do is we buy first lien mortgage notes, and we don't actually originate the loans, even though my company name is Labrador Lending. We don't actually technically lend in most cases. We will buy existing debt. So we become the bank. We become the lender who's already, you know, when a loan has already existed. And in almost all cases, those are first lien mortgage notes for us. We do dabble in land notes and some commercial notes. But my focus really is first lien and also some seconds, but my focus is first lien mortgage notes. So if a borrower, you know, in their home has fallen behind and that note becomes delinquent, many times the banks or hedge funds or, you know, other lenders, other note investors want to get rid of that sort of toxic paper, the defaulted debt, and they will sell those loans off. There were many, many of these, you know, after the 2008 crash, and there are not as many now. And so those are kind of the defaulted notes, and we can buy those at maybe 60 to 70% of the total payoff, the total legal balance of what's owed. And so if we buy that debt, our goal is to work something out with the homeowner, the borrower in most cases. But that's not always possible. And sometimes we do foreclose or work out a deed in lieu. But in an ideal world, we can do a loan modification, and that helps both the borrower and us as the quote unquote lender or investor. So we're not buying the real property. We're not buying the actual single family home in this case. We're buying the debt. And then sometimes we do end up with the real property. The real property is still very important to us. This is definitely still real estate investing, in my opinion. It's kind of a mix between finance and real estate investing. But that real property, that single family home, is our collateral. And so that's, when compared to many other types of investing, that's one of the big perks of mortgage note investing, is we have collateral. So if we're buying this note at 50% of the collateral value, the property value, again, we're not buying the property, but we're buying the note. That puts us in a pretty safe position if we've done our due diligence well. So, you know, we have that as a fallback to make sure we're made whole.
This is especially an interesting strategy here because, like, you're in kind of a unique position. Most large banks, I would imagine, they're not in the real estate business. So they, in the end, it's just a number on their balance sheet. You're kind of solving a problem for them. And in many cases, solving a problem for the current resident.
Right. For the borrower, the homeowner, as well as the bank in many cases. Now, to be clear, I don't walk into a Bank of America branch and say, show me all your defaulted assets. And it trickles down, and we buy from other note investors or smaller hedge funds or larger note funds than mine. But absolutely. And one of the key things about banks, people wonder, like, well, why would they sell at a discount? You know, banks do what's called fractional reserve lending, and they can lend so much money based on how much, if they have too much defaulted paper on their books, that limits the amount of money that they can lend. And what's crazy is they can lend money they don't actually have. And so they can kind of create almost like the federal government creating money out of thin air. But if they have too much non-performing loans, too many non-performing loans or too many defaulted loans on their books, it really hurts their capacity or their ability to lend to other borrowers. And that's really where they make a lot of money is lending.
I was going to ask you how you find these notes, but you kind of answered that already. Do you have options to do that? What level of vetting are you able to do? Is it per property? Does this come as like a batch of properties? Yeah. Do you have to buy bundles?
Great
question. How does that all look?
Typically, we are able to buy loan level, place loan level bids. Oftentimes, the sales or trades will come out as it's just an old term called a tape, but it's just an Excel spreadsheet or some type of spreadsheet. But that many times does not mean that you need to buy the whole pool or the whole offering. So this is where it does get a little complicated and dicey as far as, you know, where do we buy notes? Everybody wants to know this question, the answer to this question. They already know the question. But the truth is, it's still, as real estate is, it's a relationship space, and we build relationships with other investors, other note sellers, hedge funds, banks, you know, anybody who is in this space. And there's also a large seller financing component to this as well. So it's not always banks. You have institutional paper, and then you have seller finance paper. Seller financing is much smaller as far as in the grand scheme of things, but it's still a large component of notes that are out there to buy. So to directly answer your question, I mean, I have a list of sources that we go to buy notes. The reality is we end up going to the same sources over and over and over in many cases, because those sellers know that we will perform. We will do what we say we're going to do, from the military there. And we will buy, you know, when we say we're going to buy something, we will, as long as the due diligence checks out. So we kind of have our tried and true sources, but we are always trying to expand that. We also have I've got a lot of free resources on our website, labradorlending.com. One of those free resources is, I think it's called AI and Note Investing, Finding Sources in 2025 and Beyond. I am using AI quite a bit in general in our processes, in my business, but we're trying to incorporate it more into finding note sellers as well. Because to be frank with you, it's been harder and harder to find deals since I got into this space. But if you, there are still plenty out there. So there are online exchanges like paperstack.com people can check out. There are some other online exchanges. It's almost like eBay for mortgage notes. But the reality is it's a very inefficient space, and you're going to have your most success by building relationships, going to conferences, you know, doing podcasts, doing Zoom calls with people, and reaching out and saying, hey, this is what we're looking for. And this is why when I work with mentees, when I mentor new mortgage note investors, one of the first things we do, if not the first thing we do, is to build their buy box. And that it clearly lays out what they're looking for. And specifically, are you looking for first lien mortgage notes, second lien mortgage notes, land notes? Will you buy mobile home notes? You know, many different variety. What states are you going to buy? And that's a huge, huge piece that's overlooked often. And so we'll build that buy box. And that's really for two reasons. One is so that the note buyer, the person I'm mentoring, understands what they're looking for. Because if you don't know what you're looking for, you're likely not going to get it. And then two, there's maybe a dumbed down or simplified version of the buy box that we have our mentees, you know, provide to potential note sellers. And this says, hey, this is what I'm looking for. If you ever have anything like this, send it my way. And so, believe it or not, that works. So it does take work. And so this is where, you know, people think of mailbox money. I want to be a note investor and just, you know, put my shoes, my feet up on the desk and I'm going to print money. Well, I don't know. I mean, you can do it. You can be a passive mortgage note investor. We have a fund called the Integrity Income Fund. That's for passive accredited investors. But for the most part, this is not a passive thing. You need to be ready to work. And one of those things you need to work on is building out your sources of note sellers, or sources of notes, your list of note sellers.
You get these notes and then you're probably having to reach out to the seller, or I mean to the resident. Is it sometimes difficult to get a hold of them? Because I'm sure they're inundated with
right
back pay on not only their mortgage, but other things. There's likely something pretty...
Right. It's true. Now, we do buy performing notes as well, where the borrowers are paying, or maybe they had a hiccup in the past and that's been worked out. So in a lot of cases, the notes we buy, there's really no issue there. But we use, in almost all cases, we used a licensed third-party loan servicer, and that's the type of company that I have experience with. I've used probably six different servicers over the years. And that, for those unfamiliar with the mortgage note investing space, think of a loan servicer as a property manager. Now, the loan servicing industry comes with many more hurdles from a licensing standpoint because it is a financial institution. So there's a lot more regulation, mostly state level regulation. So it's not like a property manager in that sense where, you know, in many cases you can just become a property manager without a license, depending on the state. There's a lot more red tape. But the point is that a loan servicer's job is to collect payments from the borrower and disperse those funds to the lender or investor. Also, their job is to keep everyone compliant and keep me compliant, really. So that we're sending out the proper notices, you know, CFPB, Dodd-Frank notices, any required notices. And then it really legitimizes the note itself. And so when a licensed third-party loan servicer is keeping track of the payments, if this ever has to go to court in front of a judge and this maybe the foreclosure is contested, I can say this loan servicer that's their job. They keep records. I'm not somebody who's been driving out to the borrower's house, knocking on their door, threatening, you know, to take their home or something. This is all done through a licensed third-party servicer. We also use attorneys and other vendors. I have spoken with borrowers, but in general, it's not something that I really like to be involved with. And quite honestly, the reason is I'll probably get sucked into many of their stories. And we all have stories and hardship. And I do have discretion and I do have a heart. And so I can, listen to a borrower's, situation, understand their situation. And we've deferred payments before. We've done loan modifications before. But at the end of the day, if the borrower is not communicative, we're not able, we have no choice but to pursue foreclosure.
Mm-hmm. And then when you have the property in your possession, what do you do?
Yeah. So in most cases, we do a light rehab. We'll cut the grass, do some, you know, the biggest expense is the trash out. I've paid probably $14,000 for a trash out before and many from zero to 14. But, oftentimes, we're just doing a trash out and a light rehab. I have done a full rehab from a distance. You can check out on our website. There's a case study I have where I turned one of my rentals that I still have. It was a non-performing note in Jacksonville, Florida that we took over and we rehabbed. I've never been to Jacksonville, Florida, and this is one of the perks of mortgage note investing. You really don't need to go to these properties. It's not like hard money lending where you really need to have a crew where you're going to rehab the property and that kind of thing. To answer your question, I do a light rehab and then we'll oftentimes sell to a real estate investor, like a flipper, or if it's in good enough condition, put it on the market.
Sure. I would imagine some people are wondering, like, this sounds like, you know, when you hear the words note investing, mm-hmm. you probably have to have quite a bit of resources in your pocket in order to get involved in this. Would you say that's a myth?
I would say there's a low barrier to entry, but there almost shouldn't be. So what I mean by that is it's very easy to become a note investor. Now, whether you should or not, you know, without working with a mentor, without making sure you have resources, especially people that you know in the industry, I don't think, you know, that's a good idea to just jump in. So can you legally do it? Yes. Should you do it right away without learning, without developing a network, without having some of your own money to put to work? No.
Well, you know, going back to the loan servicing companies, mm-hmm. that particularly is something that I would point to. We attempted to do a couple of things of our own and went through a couple different loan servicing providers, and mm-hmm. and man, it is something you definitely need to know what you're doing and what questions to ask to make sure that they know what they're doing.
There are some good ones out there, and then there are others, and it's a tough industry. There's not a lot of margin as a loan servicer, and you know, you are a debt collector at the end of the day, so you have people, you know, on the phones contacting borrowers trying to ask them for money. It's not really a fun job, so to speak, right? And so, and there's a lot of regulation, like I said, and you know, just a lot of reporting requirements. It's a difficult industry. The reason we have loan servicers is because most big banks, they have their own servicing arm that they've brought it in house. They don't need a third party loan servicer. But you know, a smaller note investor, smaller lender, you typically want a third-party loan servicer. For hard money lending, it's not necessarily required. For a commercial note, you know, you don't necessarily need to follow all the same regulations. But in most cases, I still would use one.
Well, Jamie, this has been a fantastic conversation. I just want to direct everybody again to LabradorLending.com to learn more there. Take a special look and subscribe to the podcast there if you're interested in learning more about this. Before we jump into the rapid fire and close out this episode, is there anything else we should have hit on?
You know, I'll just say that we do serve both the active and passive investor. So the active mortgage note investor, if you want to learn to scale your business a little bit, we have a mentorship program. And then we serve the passive investor through our mortgage note fund, the Integrity Income Fund. And I'm happy. We have a ton of free resources on our website that I have not gone through. We haven't had time to address each one of those, but I'm happy to help people. You know, feel free to reach out. BatemanJames@LabradorLending.com.
Well, if you're ready, Jamie, we'll jump into the rapid fire and close this episode.
Let's do it, Jack.
What lie do real estate investors often tell themselves?
I think that it's going to be passive. You know, I've done presentations on, you know, mortgage note investing and whether it's actually passive or not. There are definitely ways to be passive in real estate investing. I'm not saying they're not, but in many cases, it just takes a lot more work than what you think when you're, you know, young and new. So I think we tell ourselves that it's going to be easier than it actually ends up being. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but just know that there's probably going to be some work involved, especially in the beginning.
Yeah, and I think that's becoming more and more prevalent as people continue to look for shortcuts.
Mm-hmm.
They just want the easy way.
Yep.
If you could go back in time and give your younger self a piece of advice, what would it be?
Yeah, I mean, I would say pick one niche and stick with it for a while. And then secondly, it's okay to quit something. If you've tried something and you've tried it for 3+ years, for example, it's okay to say this isn't working. I can scrap this, and I've learned a ton. Let's start over, or start something new, or just refocus. It's okay to quit.
do you have a book recommendation or what are you reading right now?
So I do have, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my own book. It's From Adversity to Abundance. People can check that out on Amazon. This is not a real estate book. It's a little bit, I know you've had over 600 episodes. I wonder if anybody has ever mentioned it, but it's called The Way of the Superior Man. It's not at all a real estate book. It is mostly for men, but I do think women may find it enlightening or educational. There it is.
The Way of a Superior Man. Yeah, no, you haven't hit. You'll be the first one on that one.
I'm reading it again. It was really good. Each chapter is kind of almost a separate, you know, separate little mini book, so you don't have to read it front to back. And it's I don't know, it really brings together kind of the East and the West and sort of our traditional knowledge, the traditional knowledge with more of like the science, I guess. So, you know, I've really found it inspirational and just rings true.
And finally, what process or tool have you implemented that has had the biggest time-saving impact?
I would say using a high-quality third-party bookkeeping company. At one point, I think I had seven LLCs and, you know, a lot going on, and it was just so much to keep track of. I did have a bookkeeper at that time, but I would say hiring a quality third-party bookkeeping company has been just a game changer for you. I don't know if it has been for you, Jack, but I use Haven Financial Services. If anybody wants to get connected with them, reach out to me. But I just don't spend a lot of time on the books anymore. And every month it used to be this super stressful thing where I was, even though I had a bookkeeper, I had to answer all these like little questions about all these little transactions. And it's like, this team knows what they're doing. Yes, we still have some reconciling to do. We still have some questions each month, but I get a report with everything rolled up into one PDF for my entities at the end of the month. And I can see profit year to date, profit from the last month, sometimes losses, you know, but it makes it easier for my CPA. So that bill goes down as well. So I would say using a third party bookkeeping company that uses software and a great team has been a game changer for me.
Well, one last time, it is LabradorLending.com. Really appreciate your time, Jamie. This was great to meet you, and I hope you'll consider coming back again sometime soon.
I'd love to, Jack. That would be awesome. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm hoping I added some value to your listeners.
Oh, absolutely did.
Thank you for joining us on From Adversity to Abundance. We hope today's episode has equipped you with valuable insights and practical advice to elevate your real estate journey. For more inspiring stories and resources, visit us at www.adversitytoabundance.com. If this episode has inspired you, please share it with a friend who could also benefit from our conversation. Together, let's turn adversity into abundance. Until next time, keep building your mental fitness and your real estate empire.
Are you ready to transform your financial future through mortgage note investing? Hi, I'm Jamie Bateman, host of the From Adversity to Abundance podcast. As a passionate entrepreneur myself and real estate investor myself, I've dedicated my career to empowering investors like you. Join my mentorship program tailored to meet your unique business objectives with a very small financial commitment to get started. Gain access to my personal experience, trusted consultants and vendors, and receive customized mentoring services. You'll get hands-on guidance on everything from determining your buy box and reviewing your bidding processes to managing notes with third-party servicers, handling collateral, and much more. Don't wait. Visit LabradorLending.com to start your journey to abundance today. Let's unlock your full potential together.